Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good day, everybody. Glad to have you on board. And if you're with us live, I'd like to extend an invitation for you to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find a link to the chat room. We've got it up and running, and Steve was there a little bit ago. We probably have a few more people. You can join in, and if you have some comments you would like to make or some observations during the course of the show, that's a great place to do it. Also, if there are some questions or some topics you would like for us to wander into over the course of the next hour, please put it in there. We will both be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we'll be glad to keep your ideas in mind as we figure out what question we want to ask next of our guests. And as always, if you don't already, you can go over to iTunes, Spreaker, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast, look up Midrats, and go ahead and subscribe. That way, we can keep you company on your commute if you don't have time to join us live. And now we're just going to plow into today's show. And over the course of the last month, it became really obvious that we've got to have John back on, because we all know a few things. It's been constant since the first person shot an arrow at the neighboring tribe canoe going down the river. The free flow of goods at market crosses, at market prices, relies on the ability of people to be able to move commerce at sea. That's the only really one of the few economically efficient ways of moving large things, heavy things, or even lots of small things for a very low price. And most of the world consumes more food and fuel than it can produce locally. Food and fuel, both are heavy, both can be expensive, and they're kind of bulky to move around. They're natural for ships. And most of the world's people today live paycheck to paycheck. And entire societies over the course of the last few decades have developed their structures around the ability for grain and oil to move economically and timely in a manner that allows them to sustain their societies. Since the Russia-Ukraine war kicked off almost 18 months ago, we've been reminded of this constant for all of human existence. When the huge amount of grain that leaves both Russia and Ukraine was being threatened in the Black Sea. And today we're going to look at where we are 18 months after that. And to come on is a returning guest to talk about this topic. We even talked about it last year, is John Conrad. John is the founder and CEO of G-Captain and author of the book, Fire on the Horizon. John, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you so much for having me, Sal. I got to say, you had the best podcast opening of any podcast in the world. This is not a drill.
No, not a drill at all, especially in this case. And I kind of touched on in the intro that, you know, mea culpa here. I did it. A lot of other people did. When if you knew how global grain moves, and you know the Arab Spring kicked off in a large part because of a spike in bread prices in Egypt and a few other places half decade plus ago. And all you got to do is know how important Ukraine and Russia is to the global train and grade, especially in South Asia, North Africa, and Southwest Asia. And that war interferes with commerce. And there was a lot of thought that we would see a very bad summer of 2022, summer of and fall of 2022, as these supply and demand did its usual course. But that didn't take place. Societies did not go into longstanding riots. Governments did not fall, minus a little occasion in Sri Lanka, but that was really due to other issues. And that was because Ukraine and Russia came to an agreement because they knew how important that was. I don't think either of them were thinking so much as the rest of the world, but themselves. And that allowed grain to flow, not in pre-war ways, but it did flow. And we have seen again that the Russians have decided that this war has gone on long enough and that they wanted to change things up again. If you could catch the listener up on that agreement that worked so well over the course of the last year and the latest threats that we're seeing to it.
Absolutely, Sal. And I want to say it's not just the agreement in Russia and Ukraine. We also had some favorable weather in some agricultural areas, and this is really tied into the bigger economic story. We had some relief on bulk ships worldwide. You know, that grain had to be replaced from places further away. And because of new environmental regulations, the UN's International Maritime Organization is putting out, ship owners don't want to build ships. So it looked like we wouldn't have enough ships, but because the Chinese economy dipped, a lot of those ships going to China were available, and we had good conditions elsewhere in the world to feed that supply. But the Ukraine Black Sea grain deal was a huge success, and it was unexpected by many people. And the same organization which is causing this, because of the new environmental rules, this shortage of bulkers and a major shortage of tankers, which really aggravated also the European energy crisis, the same organization, which I've been very critical in the past, the IMO in London, they went to Turkey, led by a former U.S. Coast Guard admiral, and brokered this deal between Turkey, Ukraine, and Russia in order to get grain ships to empty ships, really, into Ukraine, load it with grain, and export that to the world market. It was not a perfect deal, and there were some other problems. One is the mines that were floating in the Black Sea at the time were not completely cleared. And because of issues with Turkey and the consideration of what's a warship and what's not, we did not send any minesweepers in. We didn't do much minesweeping. So these mariners, these crews that went into the Ukraine were absolutely brave for doing so. Another problem was the insurance. The insurance market came up, stepped to the plate, and said, we will insure these ships, but only up to a certain limit. I think it was $50 million. I might get that wrong. But that precluded the biggest and newest and ships from going into Ukraine, so which delayed the amount of grain that was able to come out. But all in all, a lot of the millions of tons of this grain was able to be exported from the Ukraine, feed the world market. You saw with the wheat prices in Wall Street, the futures market, it spiked at the beginning of the war, and then it faded down rapidly. And this was a success, but it was not only a benefit to Ukraine. There was also significant benefit to Russia, and I don't think most of the national security, and certainly not most of the media, really understands, Russia's full intentions and what's going on here and the benefit that Russia got from this grain deal. So there's a lot still missing from the conversation.
Yeah, one of the things that people don't understand is the Montreux Convention. And I'm not I'll just put you on the spot, John. What is the Montreux Convention? Why does Turkey have all this say on what goes on in the Black Sea?
Right. So I want to say, myself and Sal Mercogliano, Sal wrote the very first article that was published even before the war of this potential, 2 weeks before the war. And when we were the first to suggest on GCAPTAIN that convoys go through, and the amount of flack we got from naval flag officers down to junior lieutenants on Twitter was unreal. I haven't received that much flack in years, but we thought it was important and continued on it. And, there was also this question of the Montreux Convention, which we believe that the media really got wrong. So the Montreux Convention is a convention back from the 1920s, I believe, that regulates what ships can and cannot go into the Black Sea. And there are various articles within the Montreux Convention that pertain at certain times. You know, in peacetime, there's a limit to the amount of ships. I believe it's three that the U.S. Navy and other NATO navies can send. And then it's a differentiate and the tonnage. So we can't send aircraft carriers. They weigh too much, and there are restrictions on submarines. But there are restrictions for the countries that are within the Black Sea, Bulgaria, Romania, Russia, Turkey, and then there are different set of restrictions for ships that are outside of the Black Sea, like the United States and most NATO countries. So this, there are different articles, and one article is Article 19 says a belligerent nation is not allowed to send warships in. So being a Black Sea nation, Russia can send and warships can go in and out pretty freely. They have a lot less restrictions than a non-Black Sea nation. But at the start of the war, Ukraine asked Turkey to designate Russia as a belligerent nation, and Turkey complied with that. And that set another into effect Article 19. Russia was labeled belligerent, and that means that Russia could not send in any other warships unless they were already Black Sea warships that were out for repair or on another mission. So they could return to the home port, but they could not bring in additional warships, and this clamped down on Russia's ability to replace the Moskva after it was sank, for instance. But it doesn't clamp down. It does clamp down on some fleet auxiliaries, but how you define what a fleet auxiliary is under question, both by Turkey and the Straits Commission, which is made up of some of the nations that are in this agreement. But it does not restrict the merchant ships from coming and going. What restricted the Ukrainian merchant ships from leaving and going to get the grain is this blockade that Russia put on the Ukraine. Merchant ships aren't restricted until you get to Article 20. Article 20 is when Turkey declares itself a belligerent nation. And then it can start restricting merchant traffic to, say, Russia. And that would come into place. It's not in place right now. It would come into place if Article 5 of NATO was enacted. And then Turkey would potentially join the fight with NATO, and then as part of that, Article 20 would allow them to lock down merchant traffic. So what this has mean, because of the blockade on Ukraine couldn't get the grain in and out, but Russia has been free to bring its oil, significant amount of oil from Novorossiya. I'm pronouncing this wrong, and its grain and fertilizer and so forth from its extensive inland waterway system, which all connects to the Sea of Azov and then the Black Sea.
Yeah, the geography here kind of lets everybody know why Russia, fought for the Crimean Peninsula back in the 1800s and wants it back from Khrushchev's gift to Ukraine. And I did it about a year ago or so, but I encourage everybody who hasn't, look at a map of the Black Sea, and over half of the water there is ostensibly, whether it's Turkey, Bulgaria, Romania, it's quote NATO water unquote. But it's that last little bit that is the issue in that stretch to the big grain ports in Odessa. And one of the things that we saw in the last decade, there are a lot of multinational companies. One is Cargill, has a tremendously modern facility that they bought into for grain in Odessa. And one thing I haven't seen in the reports, and there are large multinationals that don't just do business and have business interests in Ukraine, but also in Russia, that those the commercial interests, they have been remarkably quiet in that regard. Wondered, what have you heard in the shipping multinationals, if they had a preferred path besides everybody stop fighting, that could be some options here that we could look at?
Well, that's a really good question, Sal. And Cargill is probably, I believe, the largest shipper of any good single company in the world. It's a U.S.-based, but it's a very quiet company just in general. They don't like much publicity. They don't like to really telegraph what they're doing. They don't like to publicly step in and sway the needle. They have interest in so many ports around in so many worlds. If they were to announce any of this, they're likely to step on someone's toes. That's one. And second, they're not a public company. They're a private company, one of the absolute largest private companies in the world. So they don't talk very much. They do have an extensive maritime department. A lot of my classmates from New York Maritime College work at there. And, they are working heavily behind the scenes on moving grain and opening new terminals and, doing finance for related governments. One of them, there's been extensive buildup of the ports of the Danube River. So the Danube, people don't realize, but it connects, the Danube separates Ukraine from Bulgaria. Bulgaria is a NATO nation, but that river connects all the way to Germany and the Netherlands. It's a really, really important river system. Not only can we move grain through the Danube, and Admiral Fogo of the Navy League has published a number of articles about this, but also this investment in the transshipping facilities, where if Ukraine can get that grain into these ports on the Danube, some of that can be barged to ship ports and then moved out via ship from there. So that's sort of what's going on.
Yeah, one of the other questions that people have is, can the Danube River itself be used to move the grain upriver, so that you get it out of the either the Romanian ports or the Ukrainian ports, and send it on up into the river and barge it up the river and use the railway system that's in Central Europe and get it to other ports so that the grain could go out of Northern Europe. And I don't know if you've looked at that, but I saw that there was an article a couple of years ago, that the 15 countries, I think it was, that are on the Danube said, oh, yeah, we'd be happy to have the grain go through. But I haven't heard any more about that. Have you looked at that issue at all?
Absolutely. I rewrote an article last week called Planes, Trains, and Automobiles Can't Move Ukrainian Grain, and I posted to Twitter about, this ton-mile question. And if I could get one, I've been reading a lot of reports from the 80s on sea lift and logistics and so forth, and every report has this metric, this mathematical equation called ton-mile. It's the number of tons you can move however many miles, and it's usually per day. So it's tons times distance divided by time is the basic metric. And they're pretty much disappeared. Transcom mentions it sometimes, but very rarely now, because it really exposes some of our, particularly our airlift problems, and particularly crossing the Pacific to Taiwan. I don't want to get into that in the discussion of the Black Sea, but, so air is completely out because it just doesn't have the capacity. And they looked at trains, but there's a rail gauge problem. And Ukrainians' rail network was not meant to move grain because they had these amazing ports and never had to build it. And now with the war going on, it's difficult to build that. But even and then trucks. I mean, the amount of trucks, it was like you would need 150,000 trucks to move all the Ukrainian grain. And you need twice that number of truck drivers because of long haul. But those trucks all take up an enormous amount of fuel. And then Poland and a few other nations came out because when they started moving some of this grain via land, they were dumping it on the local market in Poland, and the local, you know, it was driving down the local price of wheat, and they were complaining that suddenly all the Polish farmers couldn't sell their wheat because they had to compete. So those options are not realistic. There are too many problems going through land. You absolutely can't go through air. It's barge up the Danube or ships. Barging up the Danube is workable. It can get a portion of the grain, but there are problems. One is the size of the vessel, a lot smaller vessels, and that's really aggravated by the enormous droughts we're having around the world. And as we look at wheat prices going forward, I don't know if you remember the big drought in the Mississippi River shut down wheat transportation here last year. The rivers in Argentina dried up the last 2 years and they couldn't export wheat. And the Danube connects to the Rhine River, which was at record low levels last year. So when these river systems go down because of the drought, you don't have the draft capability, so you can only partially load the barges. So you can't load them at full capacity. Well, these add up in cost. The smaller ships are more expensive to load. Barges, they're not as efficient, and then you can't load them full efficiency, and all the locks you have to go through and the process of the river, it's possible, but you're paying tolls, and the costs are going up. You know, you have to realize that this agreement, no one's offering to buy this Ukrainian grain at a premium. There was talk early on of that, but it's not happening. So after all this grain gets through to Germany and loaded on a ship, all of these costs are added up and it's deducted from the price that the grain is sold at. So it's very difficult for Ukraine to make a profit unless they are using ships at maximum efficiency. It's hard to make a profit of grain, period, unless you have massive efficiency, which is why cargo has grown to be so big. But you start adding in all these costs, and that comes out of the pocketbook of Ukraine. And it's not just, that Ukraine needs this money to fight the war, which they desperately do. But you have to see farmers have an incredible amount of expenses. They have to repair tractors. They have to buy fuel for the tractors. And they have to buy seed. And their biggest cost is the fertilizer. And Russia is not allowing, this is a one-way trade deal. So empty ships would get inspected in Turkey. They go to, and they have to sail to Ukraine empty, get loaded in grain, and come back out. Well, this harvest is not affected because they so over-fertilized over the last few years. They have some reserve nutrients in the ground. But that yield is going to come down after time unless these Ukrainian farmers can afford the have money for these inputs into future crops, and they're able to pay the higher value of getting fertilizer in. And by the way, one of the largest producers of fertilizer is Russia, who's not going to sell to Ukraine. So yeah, this is very much not only a military, but an economic problem, right?
Exactly. What's his name? Peter Zane. For those that are familiar with him, he's been one of the best people explaining the fertilizer challenges. And somebody who does a little bit of farming on the side, because I have too many hobbies, it's expensive really fast. You really pay attention to your soil samples because you don't want to get any. If you can save a few hundred pounds of 3400 or God forbid 0450, then that's great. But again, people haven't listened to Peter Zane. You should look him up. He does a real good job on that. in your article, I think you did a really good job outlining the fact that there's just, you know, people can have these brilliant ideas, but there's some really hard realities here that people need to be familiar with. And I'm going to do something which is always fun. I'm going to quote you back to you and get you a chance to maybe flesh it out a little bit. Under the biggest cost of all in your article over on GCaptain is, quote, perhaps the most significant cost of all is the expenditure of diplomatic capital, time, military security, and global attention on alternative transport methods that disregard simple physics and insurmountable economic costs of land or air transport. Time is of the essence, and the diversion of resources towards less efficient solutions carries a massive opportunity cost. The world's focus should be on the only rational and viable solution, ensuring the safety of grain-carrying ships from potential Russian attacks. Every moment spent on exploring impractical alternatives is a moment lost in fortifying the security of these maritime routes, unquote. And one thing we know about war, not just those that involve Russia, is the longer they go on, the more threat there is to the commerce of the opponent's nations, and the steps that were be unimaginable at the beginning of the war now become reasonable courses of action a year, 2 years into the war. And I guess that kind of brings us to where we were a year ago, that as this war, rationally want play, but I think you've outlined pretty good, whether it's truck drivers, the lack of river barges, to the going from one type of track to another, that the planes, trains, and automobiles, plan B and plan C, aren't really there. Or have the grain reserves that were, and you got different numbers from different people over the course of the last year, is that cushion there? Are the crops that we're seeing this summer going to be productive as they were to buy us more time? Because I don't see the Russians or the Ukrainians at this stage of the game being more flexible at the negotiating table for this or any other topic.
Well, I want to talk about that, and don't let me forget, because I think, you know, there was a very limited window for Russia, potentially a limited window for Russia to do this, and there's a particular reason why they're doing this now, which I want to talk about. But, you know, the opportunity cost is a big question, and, you know, Eldridge Colby has been talking on Twitter and everywhere that I listen to him, saying, you know, questioning how much we get to the Ukraine, and if that is going to be taken from our stockpile of what's needed in Indo-PACOM to fight a Pacific war. I personally believe, I think he's got a point. We have a limited supply. We have limited resources. But I am also very supportive of Ukraine. So, but this question is, you know, before this, Sal, you know, GCaptain is the most visited maritime website in the world, but we're not making headline news, right? The people aren't that interested in ships. You've talked about it extensively. Sea blindness is pernicious in our, despite America really being an island nation. We're not really taught the maritime history. We don't understand the importance. The ports, because of containerization, moved from downtown New York out to places like Newark and from San Francisco to Oakland, out of sight, out of mind. And the maritime domain was not in the public lexicon, and it was not in the political interest, and it was certainly not in the Pentagon. The Navy has some interest to military SEALs command, but I'm telling you, the Army guys and the Air Force guys, they're not reading GCaptain. And then we had COVID and the port crisis that happened, and suddenly the world's attention, you know, our page view skyrocketed, and then you had Ukraine and the Black Sea, and then the energy crisis. Well, that energy crisis wasn't a lack of energy; it's transportation of that energy. Then you have the world hunger potential crisis from that. We don't have a lack of food in the world; we have a lack of ships to move the food. And then you have the South China Sea incident escalating. That's a maritime problem. Inflation started with the port congestion in LA and Long Beach. So all our biggest headlines today are really maritime problems, and they're because we've ignored these issues for decades. And I thought, wow, you know, when I was on the show last, I think you could go back and probably replay my quote or listen to it if you want. You know, you and I lamented, and I said, man, I just wish people cared about shipyards and ships and more ships and global protection of shipping. I wish there was some interest. And when I talked to congressmen and I talked to journalists, there was just a general apathy. Now, I'm here to say now that apathy is over. You know, and I was just talking to the Navy League about this. They're going to Congress and telling Congress about, you know, that we need sealift vessels and we need shipbuilding. And there isn't a member of Congress that I've talked to. Obviously, I don't talk to all the ones who aren't interested in military, but that doesn't understand the severity of this interest, not just from the military, but an economic and a global stability. I mean, the Federal Reserve now has a ship index. They didn't have 5 years ago. So everyone, I'll declare here on your podcast that sea blindness is over. But it was kind of a false wish. This is what I wished for last time, and now I have to eat my pudding because I got what I would. Careful what you wish for. Because now what's happening, Sal, is everyone's suddenly interested in what we do, but they're not people with any expertise in what the hell's going on here. So you have aviation people like desperately trying to help, trying to come up with solutions to move grain out of the Ukraine, and they're coming against this barrier of physics, meaning you have to move it 10,000 feet in the air, which brings up a huge amount of problems. And it's not just here, but, you know, look at renewable energy and the electrification of vehicles. It's, yeah, this is a great idea. We need to electrify vehicles, but where's this copper coming from? The mines, how are we getting the ships to move this from around the world? So now I think sea blindness is gone. Everyone knows we have a problem, but no one has the expertise to fix these problems. And the solutions they're bringing in, because they want to help, is causing the problems to get worse. You know, and the general, I forget his name, that Rommel studied under, who was really Rommel's hero, said, you know, there are smart people and motivated people. And he said, unmotivated, you know, dumb people, there are a lot of them in the Army, they do the grunt work, right? And you got to give them a little motivation. And then the motivated dumb people, they make mistakes, but they don't make mistakes that are really big, right? And then he said there are the highly motivated, intelligent people who they run into these problems and they make huge mistakes. And because they're so intelligent, they create problems that we can't solve. They make the problems worse. And he said he liked to hire people who are a bit lazy and highly intelligent because they, not that they don't do work, but they spend their time figuring out how to do the least amount of work in the future, you see? So now we have these highly motivated, I don't want to say do-gooders because they have good intentions, but they don't know shipping and they're putting their resources into trains and planes, and the journalists are covering this because planes are more interesting than ships, and the world attention is going into these wrong buckets, and we're wasting a lot of money and resources, and we're making some of these problems a lot worse.
Yeah, that's I see the same thing. I saw that you had published the piece by General Stavridis. I mean Admiral Stavridis about we could escort these ships like we did during Ernest Will. And you know, I don't know if everybody's looked at the problems involved in using any kind of U.S. ship, if you can get the Turks to let them through into the Black Sea, to who are not the flag the ships that are going to be carrying the grain are not ships that are flagged in the U.S., which we did for earnest when we, you know, the Kuwaitis, whoever agreed to reflag their ships. But, you know, the laws involving this sort of thing are international law involving this stuff is, and I always laugh at international law because I don't think there's a whole lot of it that makes a darn bit of difference. But if you're going to lay your ships out there, U.S. ships or German ships, to escort these vessels, and the Russians attack them, you're creating a potential Article 5 of NATO situation, which I'm sure the Russians don't want, but I'm also pretty sure we don't want that either. And there are a lot of issues. Perhaps I'm being too legalistic about this, but the complications of trying to convoy these ships are pretty heavy. And just speaking after several years in the old naval control of shipping business, so I think I do understand convoy ops. But talk a little bit about that. I mean, I know that I think you were impressed with what Admiral Stavridis said.
Right. So you know, first I want to say that you know, I don't know if you remember, but fairly early in the war, some missiles that were heading to Ukraine accidentally went into Poland, and everyone's like, is this going to cause Article 5? And, you know, it didn't. You know, Poland's got to say, we want to enact Article 5 before, and they didn't want it because it was a mistake and there was no major damage. But, you know, it was this big media event. What wasn't a media event is, Bulgarian ships were attacked, and another foreign flag ship was attacked in the territorial waters of Bulgaria. So you have to ask the question, is that considered Article 5 defense? Can Bulgaria say, you know, they attacked our vessels and they attacked other vessels that are within our territorial sea, so 12 miles out? And the problem is that the world didn't ask that question. So I was one of the first to say that we should have convoys, and I'm looking at Twitter. Sophia Witt, who's an officer in the German Navy, wrote an article, a tweet yesterday, which explains why convoys are a bad idea. And I disagree with her point. I disagree with your point, Mark. I think convoys can be effective, and there are ways to mitigate that risk, one. And two, we have to show the shipping world that we are willing to protect merchant ships, because if we don't do it here, you know, China's paying attention and they're looking that we're letting these ships go without escorts and without mine clearing. And it's sending a bigger message by not doing anything. And instead, you know, when I first proposed let's send convoys, there was this huge eruption of anger, which was dissipated thanks to Admiral Stavridis and Admiral Fogo and a few others who say, hey, maybe this will work. But my real point was we have to have this conversation and look at ways to push back against Russia and protect these ships. And while I disagreed with Sophie's post here, you know, at the end she said, we can't do convoys, but there's something we can do. Let's send minesweepers in and get these mines off. And, you know, even the Danube, some of these floating mines are going in the Danube. You know, where are our small boat squads that can detect and find these mines? That's one. And two is the advice to shipping has been really, really poor. So, you know, when the captain of this grain ship goes into the Black Sea, he doesn't know where these mines are. He doesn't know how many mines. It was the last thing. He goes to NATO Control of Shipping and gets a report. And there's also supposed to be a report issued by the U.S. Maritime Administration. And the NATO one is mediocre. At least it had a chart and some maps of where some of the mines might have been, but it was only published every few days, and the MARAD one wasn't published at all for weeks, and then they left the same one up there for 6 months. So there are things, maybe we can't send the convoys in on the traditional route of hey, diddle diddle right up the middle, but can we bring in a few warships in and keep them within that 12-mile zone? can we use land-based defense systems if these ships are staying within the 12-mile zone? And this is exactly what the Ukrainians asked for a few days ago when the Green Deal ended. They said, hey, listen, let's not send these ships into international waters where you have all these problems. Let's keep these grain ships within the territorial seas and then use air defense, land defense, and hopefully a few warships or at least minesweepers to protect ships within NATO's territorial sea. And I support that wholeheartedly. I support sending naval officers on these grain ships to help the captains figure out where these mines are. I support overflights of mine detection and real-time reporting through the U.S. Maritime Administration, not once every few weeks, but real-time reporting of where the mines, at least that they can see, are. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit here, Mark, and I believe in convoys, but we don't have to go right up the middle and intimidate Russia. And there are legal things we can do, as we did in Operation Earnest Whale, where we say, hey, these have to be U.S. flagships with U.S. Officers, and that gives us a legal right to put some naval support on to look at these mines and so forth. And so when people think convoy, they're thinking Battle of the North Atlantic. When I'm thinking convoy of ships in the Black Sea, I'm looking at let's get these ships through with the support that in which we can mitigate risk. And I think Admiral Stavridis and Admiral Fogo and some of the other commentators who have slowly been joining these. Blake Herzinger came out the other day and changed his opinion on this. So I think, but we're not having these conversations, right? Because everyone automatically assumes the Montreux Convention precludes warships from going in. It isn't. The day of the Montreux Convention, Russia was deemed belligerent. Turkey made a diplomatic request that no other warships come in, and that hasn't been challenged. You know, the UK a few months later offered, I believe it was with Italy, to bring some minesweepers into it, and that got shot down, particularly by, I don't have hard proof, but I've had some sources. The U.S. Navy and the Department of Defense is very much against this, and European command, and hasn't allowed it because no one wants to upset Turkey. Right. And everyone, Admiral Stavridis said today to like the same people who think that by, the same people who are against warships are the ones who thought Turkey was sided with Russia and would never let Finland and Sweden in. And they are playing both sides to some extent, but they did help negotiate this deal. They are pushing for NATO interests, maybe not as much as we want, but maybe we can't get an Ollie Burke destroyer in there, but I don't see why we can't get smaller corvettes and some mine layers. Maybe not to provide complete protection, but in order to, help with this mine problem at the very least.
Yeah, this sounds a little cynical, but I have good reasons. Turkey is just playing one side. Turkey, they are what they
Correct.
Are.
Absolutely.
One thing that's frustrated me about this conversation, and we've been doing it ourselves here, is this is more than anything else a European problem. From Spain to France to Italy, you don't even have to bring the Greeks into the equation because of their relationship with the Turks. You don't have to bring the Turks into the relationship. Into the conversation because of their relationship to everybody but themselves. But NATO has a lot of navies that have a vested interest in stopping prices from spiking and supply problems plummeting in North Africa and South Asia. And the instinct, and a lot of it is the American's fault, is America can solve this. The Black Sea is a large lake connected to the Mediterranean Sea in the heart of Europe. Europe has the lead on it. Europe's have been dealing with the Turks for about 1,000 to 1,500 years longer than we have. They'll find a way to work with them. But having a U.S. DDG from the front, which will actually tie into my next question. That's not my approved COA. But you mentioned earlier, for the listeners that aren't familiar with it, one of my favorite quotes. It's better in the original German, but I won't do that because my German is worse than my French. But the quote was by General Oberst Kurt von Hammerstein-Eckhord, which I can't pronounce the last part of his name. He passed away in 1943. But in English, the full quote is, "I divide my officers into four classes as follows: the clever, the industrious, the lazy, and the stupid. Each officer always possesses two of these qualities. Those who are clever and industrious, I appoint to the general staff. Use can, under certain circumstances, be made of those who are stupid and lazy. The man who is clever and lazy qualifies for the highest leadership posts. He has the requisite and the mental clarity for difficult decisions. But whoever is stupid and industrious must be got rid of, for he is too dangerous." That was about 1933 he made that quote. But, yeah, that can apply to a lot of things that we see people talking about, especially on Twitter. But let's go back. And you talked about, you brought it up recently, shore-based assets that can help support shipping ashore. Going south from Ukraine, we have the Iranians making trouble again. And this week we announced CNN, same thing. Anyway, CNN outlined a couple days ago, quote, "The U.S. is deploying thousands of Marines and additional forces to the Middle East following recent Iranian attempts to seize commercial shipping vessels," the Pentagon announced Thursday. The latest deployment comes after the Pentagon said earlier this week that it would be sending F-35s and F-16 fighters to the Middle East, as well as the USS Tom Hudner, a guided missile destroyer, unquote. Again, Arleigh Burke to the front. But a couple things that are missing in this conversation, I think. One, we have lots of friendly navies in the area from nations who are half a day steaming from this location that I don't hear much talk of. We have our European allies. We have other allies in Asia who don't seem interested to participate, unlike what we saw with Task Force 151 off Somalia. Maybe this takes time to ruminate, and they're waiting for the U.S. to lead. But I also wanted to give your take, and you can feel free to dive into our lack of frigates if you want to, but I don't think F-16s, A-10s, and F-35s are really the best merchant ship escorts that we've seen in the history of escorts since 1903.
Right, and we absolutely need frigates, and I think, you know, big support of building that. And
classic frigate job, right?
Problem. Absolutely, huge, huge. Why are we sending, you know, Arleigh Burke comes up as this thing because, you know, we don't have alternatives, cheaper alternatives. But you're absolutely right, but, you know, and there was a lot of discussion online. Like I said, there were a few nations that were looking to put minesweepers into the Black Sea, and that really changed. When Vice Admiral Peter Daly of the Naval Institute had a interview, it was recorded with Admiral Gilday, and asked him point blank, like, why aren't we, you know, he was asking about hospital ships, and this was a time when there was a lot of civilians being caught in the crosshair of the evacuations out of the Ukraine, and they said, why don't we bring some LCSs in or some unarmed expeditionary fast support ships. And, you know, Gilday made it very clear that any, any movement of the Navy through the Bosphorus is going to be considered by Russia escalatory, and that is a major problem. And I think our allies really looked at that, and they're willing to do things on themselves. I knew some of these, I talked to some of these foreign admirals. Some of them were privately very eager to, and they can. And it's not that they need the Navy's leadership. I don't think we have to step up and say, you know, let's be first and let's organize this. But, you have to at least condone it when the most powerful Navy in the world, which because all the other navies are so small, they need the U.S. protection. I don't think they're going to stand up and do something and which is potentially dangerous. And let's say these convoys, it is a dangerous job. Then a British minesweeper gets blown up right after the CNO said, hey, this is a bad idea. That's not really politically viable for that nation. It really puts them in a corner. But you also have to realize even Gilday's remarks were back, you know, right after the nuclear power station was under attack and Russia was threatening nuclear weapons, and it was before the Moskva. So, you know, the problem is that I can't speak for all the allies, I believe when the head of the U.S. Navy came up and said this is a horrible idea to Vice Admiral Daley in this interview, you know, that sent a strong message to Sal. It's often, I don't think it was a message saying we're going to prevent you guys. I think if the UK really wanted to send, I don't think the U.S. Navy would stop them. We'd probably even help them. But, I think that really shut things down.
Yeah, I was looking back at it. The Dutch, among other European countries, did offer up minesweeping services back in June of last year. And, you know, like a lot of things, people offer and then something else happens where they don't come through. But as I recall, and I was trying to look at it, but I couldn't find it, I thought the Romanians and the Bulgarians had put some of their minesweeping boats out there to help clear part of the channel for these grain ships. But I don't know if that was, you know, just in their own waters or they were actually going off the Ukrainian waters.
And I believe Turkey helped too, you know, clear those mines. But
I appreciate your thoughts on the convoy thing, and I think that, you know, I too thought about the offshore stuff, and that is a harder challenge because, as you know, it's really hard to detect mines when you're sitting on the beach someplace. So that is an issue if that is the main threat. I have questions about what the main threat is because Russia's they've been exercising apparently the last day or two. They've been taking some of their missile frigates and corvettes and been shooting off their weapons to show what could happen, and then that gets the question. And I think we were going to address this, so now's a good time. What the heck are the Russians up to? What are they looking for? Are they looking for another great deal like they got with the grain deal, or are they trying to make a big stir where all the humanitarians will go, well, the people in Somalia and Afghanistan and Bangladesh are going to starve unless we do something? So he's going to try and force world opinion to tell the Ukrainians to give up in some way.
Well, I love the absolutely love the post from my friend Captain BJ Armstrong, who's works with Claude over at the Naval Academy. Claude works in the museum. BJ is a history professor, but he's active duty, and he says, you know, this people keep telling me this isn't a maritime war, but it is very much a maritime war for all these reasons. The Moskva and the blockade and the ships going out of, you know, the oil and the sanctions issue. And there's so many deep, deep maritime complexities in this. But I want to step up and take that a step further. Because if you rewind the clock to a year before the incident, you know, the invasion of the Ukraine, when the Ever Given was stuck in the Suez and Sal Marcagliano started his channel, Putin came out right after that and said, this is a major problem because the Black Sea is so critical for Russia, and we don't trust that we can get out of the Western Med because of, you know, U.S. forces in Italy and road to Spain. And so he felt boxed in, and then with the Suez problem, he really felt boxed in, and I can't tell you the absolute critical nature of this area is for him. And he said right there, I think he was putting $16 billion into connecting the inland waterways to the Baltic and really beefing up the inland canals and waterway system. This is absolutely vital to Russia. And how I would want people to think about this is the Kerch Strait, and you know, you see the Kerch Strait bridge being blown up, and the taking Crimea and everything else, but that Kerch Strait is to Russia what New Orleans is to the United States. You have the Don River, and that connects to all these extensive inland waterway systems. And Peter Zeihan goes into it in his book, the absolute vital importance of these waterway systems to agriculture and oil and transport. But all of those water systems, and then in the U.S. we have the Great Lakes connected to the Mississippi, but in Russia you have the biggest freshwater lake in the world, the Caspian, connects through. But all of those go down, connecting to the Don River, raw stuff on the Don, and then the barge traffic has to sail through the Sea of Azov and through the Kerch Strait. And if that is closed off, if that's blockaded by Ukraine or anyone else, it shuts off a huge percentage of the Russian economy and really puts Russia in a bad place. So we look at, like, why was this green? Why did Russia agree to this green deal? And I believe, why did Russia start this war in the first place? And you have to look at, imagine if, you know, China took over, you know, New Orleans, or had built these islands right outside of New Orleans. That would be a, that would put a major threat to us because of the absolute criticality New Orleans is to our system. Same with Russia, and that's why he originally took Crimea in 2014. That's why he built the Kerch Strait Bridge to kind of prevent big ships from getting into Mariupol. And that's why, you know, he went for Kiev in the beginning, and that took the headlines. But his main objective and what he's held on the strongest is Mariupol. And if you look at the Ukrainian, you know, pushback, it's a pushback towards Mariupol. The heaviest fighting now is in Bakhmut, because right at the start of the war, you know, when Ukraine surged ahead and Russia had to retreat, the artillery, Ukrainian artillery in Mariupol was attacking this barge traffic, and the barge traffic stopped in the Sea of Azov. It completely stopped in the Kerch Strait. They couldn't get any of this fertilizer, any of the grain. The Russian grain and fertilizer and oil and all the stuff that comes down the river, and you can go on marine traffic and just see how many barges, it's really a large number, was all completely stopped. So Russia had to give Ukraine the deal in order, and they had to take Mariupol in order to allow this, which is absolutely vital to the Russian economy would collapse if that got lost. And then Russia pushed back. They took Mariupol. They pushed west from Mariupol into Bakhmut, and they're very strongly holding that because they absolutely can't let Ukraine get Mariupol, because again, the shore-based artillery will stop the Russian traffic in coming down their major, all of their major river systems. So I believe this is happening now because right now Russia does not need the grain deal. It secured Mariupol. It's got a little bit of buffer, and the traffic is flowing nicely. But it could be a month from now. It could be a week from now. It could be tomorrow that Ukraine breaks through into Mariupol, and then Russia will need that grain deal, right? They will need it more than Ukraine does, and they'll happily jump back into the grain deal, and the UN, Prussia, and everyone else will push Ukraine back into the grain deal. But this is a card, if he doesn't use now, expires the moment that Ukraine pushes back into Mariupol. And I really believe this is the central part of the war. You did the army and the Javelin missiles and the tanks and the attack on Kiev, that all got the headline. And of course, our European command is an army general, and, you know, our Secretary of Defense is an army general, our Joint Chief of Staff is an army general. I think that narrative is being tailored for the Army side, and that's what the journalists know after 20 years of reporting on the global war of terror. But my personal opinion is this isn't a land war at all. This is all about maritime control of the charge point at the Kerch Strait.
And like we talked at the beginning of the show, if people haven't done recently, get out a map of the Black Sea area. And it's something that has the rivers on it, too. And it all, I think you put that really well. It does go back to the water. And that is, believe it or not, an hour. We really appreciate, John, you taking time to spend an hour today talking about a topic I know we could both spend all day on. If you could, for the listeners, if they wanted to keep track of what you're doing, not just on G-Captain, but elsewhere, where's a good place for them to keep an ear out and out for?
GCaptain.com, and it's on all the social media, at GCaptain on Twitter, and then my personal Twitter account is at John Conrad, K-O-N-R-A-D, over at Twitter. So that's where I try to post there and follow the amazing work of my two favorite cells and Eagle One.
Perfect. John, it's a pleasure as always. Really appreciate you taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, John. Appreciate it. Good stuff today.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. And until next time, we hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand.